Good morning. Welcome to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. My name is Lisa Bodwin, and I am the moderator for this morning's program. Since 1828, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is held at the historic Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown Peterborough, New Hampshire, at 11 o'clock on Sunday summer mornings. We invite our New Hampshire Public Radio audience to attend these programs and to meet our speakers at the reception following the program. After the talk, I will read questions from our live audience. Our speaker today is Ms. Tracy McMillan. Ms. McMillan was raised in rural Michigan, where typical meals for her included, among her favorites, tuna and hamburger helper, iceberg lettuce salads, country crock spread, and miracle whipped pasta salad. Eating food that took too much time or money was for fancy people. She grew up, she became a journalist in New York City covering poverty issues, and nearly a decade later, she stumbled upon the politics of food. Ms. McMillan became interested in how food works in our lives, how priorities around health and convenience and cost shift when resources are tight. After stripping away some of her own class-based assumptions, she came to the fundamental question, what would it take for all of us to eat well? Thus began her year-long journey, working in farm fields harvesting America's produce alongside migrant workers, then to stocking the produce section of Walmart, and finally in the kitchen of Applebee's restaurant. Ms. McMillan has explored the intricate linkages from farm to plate to understand what she prefers to call a foodscape rather than a food system. Her detailed investigative account provides compelling statistics and data on how food is harvested, distributed, marketed, and consumed. But more interestingly, she provides us with an understanding of our nation's food culture. Who eats what and why? And what are the economic forces that shape our food culture? She brilliantly delivers to the reader a greater understanding of this system, so that we can improve for all, but particularly the working poor, who are largely responsible for putting food on our plates, greater access to good fresh food, which she now regards as a social good and a human right. Please join me in warmly welcoming Tracy McMillan.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for spending your Sunday afternoon with me. I really appreciate it. I'm going to be speaking today about two of my primary obsessions, which are food and economic class. Before I get there, I do have a couple of thank yous, mostly to the folks of the Lyceum. It's really humbling to me to get to speak here for all of you. And Nancy Horowitz invited me, Catherine helped to coordinate, and Ron and Judy have been really gracious hosts to me, and I just want to say how much I appreciate that and how exciting it is to not just be speaking here, but to be adding to this rich program that you've been having going on with the farm tours and everything, and that's really exciting to me. Before I really get into the meat of my talk, I want to make sure we've got a couple of base ideas out of the way, and first is that I'm a journalist. So my job here is not to give you a solution or tell you how things will work in the future. But I, by virtue of my profession, I get the opportunity to see and study and experience things that most people don't have time to in their daily lives. So I can share with you sort of what I've come to think based on my experiences. And the second thing that I want to talk about, and Lisa did a good nod to this, right, is how I came to food, because I think it's a really instrumental piece of the discussion that's happening in the U.S. here, right? Because I don't come to food writing because I love food. I do love food, and I'm as thrilled as anyone with the sort of re-emergence of an interest in smaller farms and local farms, sustainable food systems, but it's not an aesthetic love of food that brings me before you today. I'm a working-class kid from outside of Flint. And, you know, I ate a lot of Hamburger Helper growing up, and that happened not because my family didn't care, right, about what we ate, but because my mom was sick, my dad was effectively a single parent, and he was trying to figure out the best way to feed three girls, right, on a budget, both in terms of time and money, when we lived in a rural place where the closest grocery store was 10 miles away. It's really a big part of my background that I was raised to not be a snob. In fact, we were kind of snobs about not being snobs. And so food, right, was this thing where, well, it's a really easy shorthand. How are you a snob? Well, you're a snob if you eat fancy lettuce, right? Or you're a snob if you can't be bothered to eat the Miracle Whip. And so I grew up thinking, right, that my food identity was sort of very integral to me not being a snob. And then something happened, which is that I graduated high school. I got a college scholarship to NYU. And all of a sudden, to put myself through school, I was working in the households of the 1%. And all of a sudden, I had access to the most amazing food I had ever seen, right? So part of my job was to help prepare dinner. So I literally would get given a change purse and told, like, go to Gourmet Garage, which is this very lovely, beautiful grocery store in Manhattan that's full of, you know, like Kaibut chocolate and chunks that you can take home to have for dessert and beautiful cheeses and all these things. And my job was to just cook whatever I felt like with that. And all of a sudden I was eating this great food and I was like, well, snobs get to eat this? Well, maybe snobs aren't so bad. Right? But at the same time, because I was engaging with folks who had a lot more sort of privilege and comfort than I did, when I talked to them about where I was from and that I had eaten the Hamburger Helper and the Tuna Helper, you know, they laughed at this, right? This was funny to them. And initially, because I was a kid, I was like, yeah, that is really funny. But I felt kind of weird about it. And over time, I felt weird. I felt sort of ashamed. And over time, I came to really feel like, you know, that's not funny. That's just what was available to my family. So when I stopped thinking that the food that I ate growing up was funny, right, it opened up this question about what other ideas about food do we have and carry with us that are wrong? And that's really what led me to do this book, The American Way of Eating. I'm going to start my talk today making a proposition to you all, which is that everybody wants good food. And there is a second piece of this proposition, which is that not only does everybody want good food, but that having a frank discussion about food in America could begin to shift paradigms within American political discourse. And truthfully, that's what gets me most excited about food, right, is being able to use it to speak about broader truths in the U.S. So this first premise, everybody wants good food. This sounds kind of obvious, but it's really not. We hear contradictions about this all the time. And so we hear it very frequently even in the top ranks of the local and sustainable food world. Alice Waters is an amazing and an inspirational chef and leader in this movement. She has done phenomenal work to bring good quality food to low-income students in the East Bay, out in the San Francisco area. She builds gardens and schools so that kids learn about food. She can talk beautifully about how good food is a right and not a privilege. But she will also say very openly and very casually that some people, they want to nourish themselves, and some people just want Nikes. And we need to change that. And that is her conception, right, essentially of the parents of these kids who she is helping, you know, to learn about food. And we hear sort of a contradiction and a disconnect about this idea that everyone wants good food when supermarkets executives tell us, well, we don't open stores in that neighborhood, in that town, in that community because there is no demand there. There is no market for our products there. Which sounds reasonable until you consider what that actually means, which is that nobody in that community must eat. I'm going to share a couple of stories with you guys from the reporting in my book, and outside of the book also. I've been covering food and food access and poverty for most of my professional life at this point. I'm actually trained as a welfare reporter and then moved into this food stuff. So the first story I want to start with actually comes from probably a year or two before I began reporting the American way of eating. And I met this woman named Devaney Jackson. Devaney and her husband, Robert, live in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. Most of you may have heard of this neighborhood. It's one of the iconic black ghettos of the 20th century in New York City. It is where the rapper Biggie Smalls is from. It's where Chris Rock is from. It is where Mos Def, so a lot of rappers and comedians actually come out of there. Richard Wright, this amazing African-American writer of the 20th century, lived in the same neighborhood. And it's generally been considered a food desert. And in the early 2000s, the Jacksons, who are religious folks, I'm not sure of their denomination, they opened the Brooklyn Rescue Mission in the basement of a brownstone to feed and minister to the hungry. So they opened a food pantry. Neither Devaney or Robert are the sorts of people that you would sort of think of when you think foodie, right, or local food freak person. So they're heavyset, they're both African-American, they're not hip, they're not trendy, they're not wearing embroidered bags, they're not snooty, they're just definitely not foodies. And yet when they began to coordinate the food donations to this food pantry, they were shocked because all the food that they could get was processed. It was in cans, it was in airtight plastic wrap, it would not rot, which was good for longevity, but it was terrible for the health of the people that they were feeding to. And they knew that this was wrong, right? They thought, if we are trying to help the hungry, why are we feeding them crap, right? So they did something that has since become very trendy. They planted a garden in the empty lot behind their mission. And when it yielded more than they could give away, they sold it as a farm stand. And the farm stand did well. So these low-income folks that were coming to take advantage of the food pantry took as much produce as they could. They still had more, and they were able to sell it right on the sidewalk in their neighborhood. Now, this was at a period in New York City's history when people were starting to talk about bringing farmers markets into low-income communities, and farmers often balked, right? They said, well, we don't really know if we can make money there, and it's a lot of work, obviously, to expect a farmer to pack up everything and take it into, you know, drive through New York City to get to Bed-Stuy. And so they had a very difficult time recruiting farmers. But then they were able to say, well, we have this farm stand. It's doing pretty well. And now they have a weekly farmer's market in the park across from their brownstone. It has four or five farmers. It does really well. They take food stamps, which helps to really support the program. This was really, really interesting to me, right? So these people who are not foodies and they're not snooty, they decided to just grow food and see if people would buy it, and they did. And not in like Union Square, which is a very high-end market district in New York, but in Bed-Stuy. And I'm not talking the gentrified part of Bed-Stuy. I'm talking like deep out, far, often, you know, a little dicey. And that went really well for them. So, you know, that really made me think, wow, there might be something to this food stuff, right? Like somebody should keep an eye on this. So I went and I began reporting this book, The American Way of Eating. And probably one of the favorite moments for me in doing this book, and I just have to tell you, I had such an amazing experience. I just feel so blessed and privileged that I was able to spend a year going and meeting the people that feed me. Right, because this is something that had not occurred to me before. Like, I am here before you today not just because I wrote a book or I'm talented or I work hard or I'm lucky. I'm here because there are thousands of people across the country and across the globe working to feed me. Right, I can walk into a store and just pick up food and I will be fed. And that doesn't happen magically. That happens because people are working for me. And that's really, for me, it's been very humbling to realize that. And something that also I thought was very humbling for me was when I was in Detroit. I did a chunk of my reporting from Detroit. So I lived on the city's southwest side, and I commuted out of Detroit to a Walmart to work in the grocery store. In the Northeast, we don't tend to understand this as much. I certainly didn't know this until I started reporting on it. Walmart is the biggest grocer in the U.S. and the world. It accounts for at least a quarter of the American food supply. It is bigger than the next three largest grocers combined in terms of market share. This is a degree of concentration that is unprecedented in American history. This has never happened before. In the 19-teens, A&P came under fire for having too much market share because people were concerned about the control it yielded over our food system, and its market share was 16%. And that was something that actually brought up antitrust legislation, right? And so Walmart, significantly bigger than that. So I went to Detroit to work at a Walmart, and I picked Detroit because Detroit is this, okay, A, I'm from Michigan, so I was excited to get to go to Detroit. But also, Detroit gets talked about a lot as a food desert, as a place where there is an insufficient food supply and insufficient grocery stores. And Detroit has about 85 grocery stores, but it's an insufficient number of stores for the people that live there. The metric that most people use to measure food access is square footage per person. 3 square feet per person is what the industry standard decides, when a market is sufficiently met, and Detroit has half of that, 1.5 square feet per person. So I thought this would be a really interesting place to be. And I went to Eastern Market, which is Detroit's big sort of wholesale farmers market. And this is something that is disappearing around the country and has been for quite a while. Eastern Market is, this big old market district, brick buildings, big brick and steel sheds that were designed initially for farmers to drive their wagons into to sell their produce to people at market. And now it functions essentially like that. And it's one of the few cities in the country that still has a regional food infrastructure in place. And this has been dying off because stores like Walmart now control all of the distribution. Right, one of the ways that food prices have dropped over time has not just been downward pressure on suppliers, on farmers, but it's been the fact that Walmart and all of these other stores are bringing all the logistics between farm and store in-house, which streamlines their cost, but also streamlines all of that movement and privatizes all of the movement of our food around this country. So the USDA used to track this. If you were like, where did these apples come from in this neighborhood? Like, where would they have come from? You could sort of figure it out. USDA stopped tracking this in the 90s because supermarkets, which are private businesses, now control so much of the regional distribution infrastructure that the USDA said, well, it's not even worth us tracking anymore. We have no idea. And so I went to Eastern Market to sort of study how this works. And I ended up there at a time when a new program is being introduced called Double Up Food Bucks. So this is basically a coupon program for food stamp clients where they match dollar for dollar up to $20 a week for fresh, local, Michigan-grown produce. So I was sitting in the office where you have to come in and redeem your food stamp card and you get these tokens. And I met this woman, Patty Good. And I really just became such a big fan of this woman. So she looked like most of the moms that I grew up with. So she was low income. She's a cashier at a Kmart. White woman, long straight hair, no makeup, jeans, baggy t-shirt, cheap sneakers. She was not a fancy looking person. She lived in Dearborn Heights, which is a sort of down at the heels suburb of Detroit. It's about 13 miles from the city center. Looking at her, right, I would have assumed, being somebody that's lived in New York for a long time, that she was eating Hamburger Helper and Miracle Whip, and that she sort of picked that, right? That's what she eats. And yet she had driven in 13 miles one way to get $20 extra in produce. So I was talking with her, and I was sort of like, okay, oh, so you like the program, that's great, and what do you normally buy? And we're talking, she said, well, I don't get to buy very fancy food very often. Oranges are expensive. And I'd like to point out, right, for me as someone that, and particularly as a single person who can eat whatever, I have a very flexible income. I don't have a lot, but I can do whatever I want. But, to hear a mom tell me, well, oranges are expensive. These are typically one of the cheaper items in the store. For me, it was really sobering. She said, okay, well, what do you buy with the program? You've been using this Double Up program for a bit. And it was like asking a music nerd to tell me about their favorite bands, because she started chronicling vegetables and fruit like they were a set list. So she talked about, oh, I got to get a pineapple once and Brussels sprouts. She started going off about Brussels sprouts and how you could get them on the stalk, and so they were super fresh. And this is a woman that looks like she's going to a NASCAR rally, right? Which for like somebody from New York, right, it's a bit of a cognitive dissonance. And so I thought, well, this is really, really interesting. Like, she cares about her food. And I think that that's what's transformative about these stories from Patty and the Jacksons, because nobody that I met really needed to be talked into eating well. And I'm not saying there aren't some people that don't care about how they're eating, or they're going to eat crappy food, or they need to get some nutrition education. Like, there's a lot of that too. But I have met a huge number of people where they didn't need to be convinced to eat well. What they needed were for their lives to work in a way that it was relatively easy to do so. And so the question I want to pose to you now is, if this is what we want, right? Is the world that Patty and the Jacksons are living in, is this what we want? You know, today, 2/3 of the nation is overweight or obese, and 1 in 3 kids born in 2000 are expected to develop type 2 diabetes. These are diseases that are entirely preventable, right? These are things based on your foodscape, on your diet, on the things that surround you. They are not based on random bacterial infections, right? Diet-related disease, right? So heart disease, diabetes, obesity, all that stuff, it's on pace to sort of, it is on track to outpace tobacco as the number one killer. And so we're faced with this avalanche of diet-related disease. And so the question that I keep coming up against is, you know, does it make sense to have eating well be something that requires you to drive 13 miles each way just so you can get a coupon to afford it, right? Or is it reasonable to have it work such that feeding the poor a diet that will not make them sick requires the Herculean effort of remediating a vacant lot in an urban area and learning to farm it, right? And at the core, right, this question is like, are we cool with the idea that good food is a luxury product? Because that's how we usually treat it, you know? And we see this in a lot of our discussions around food. I fully believe in buying the things that I want to support, but at the same time, I really balk at the idea that I should vote with my fork. Because really what that is that means I'm supposed to vote with my dollar. And by extension, right, that means that somebody with more money gets to vote more than somebody with less. And I don't feel comfortable with that. And we also see this sort of idea that food is a luxury product, just even in the tradition I'm a part of, in food writing, right? Which is that, you know, gourmandism, right? This idea that like food is this luxurious, beautiful, transformative thing, which it can be. But I mean, that's a piece of culture that's very much tied to the elites. And so all of the narratives and stories that we've had about food that have been taken seriously have come from that tradition. And this is part of what led me and my family when I was growing up, right, to reject the idea that we should take our food seriously. The only people whose stories that were taking food seriously we ever heard were from people with a radically different set of opportunities and pressures on them, right? So when you have like writers for The New Yorker writing and writing and writing about food, right, it tends to make it seem to anybody, you know, that's sort of outside of that, that, well, if you care about food, right, you must be the sort of person that reads The New Yorker. Which is strange. I'm not defending this as the most rational presumption ever. But I think that that's something, that's a bit of how it works. And so I come back to this question, right? Are we cool with this? Like, are we cool with the idea that healthy food is a luxury? And this isn't just some rhetorical food for thought question, because I think that this is a very real and very hard question. And since, you know, I get to stand up here and talk at you for a bit, I have an advantage here, so I get to tell you my answer, which is like, no, right? I'm not cool with that, you know, because healthy food is necessary for life. Right, and this is where my talk probably gets like a little further afield than things you might have heard about food before, because I think I want to posit to you that healthy food is like fresh and clean water, right? We don't accept as a country or a society that access to clean water in your home is a privilege, right? I've had a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, in Detroit, the reason there aren't enough grocery stores is, you know, there's these bombed out low-income neighborhoods and people don't have money. And, you know, there's a lot of violence. And I say, well, that's true. That does make it difficult to run a store. All those neighborhoods pretty much still have water. And we don't say, well, there's a bunch of really broke people and there's a lot of violence, so we should just cut off the water to their community. You know, and so after spending a year living and working in the food system, right, I really have been asking myself, like, why do we treat food differently than water? What is the reasonable reason to do that? And I don't think there is one. This is a kind of radical political point in American discourse right now. This idea I have, right, about food being like water has actually gotten me a lot of completely unexpected attention from the right wing. So it's true. I can tell you this because Rush Limbaugh, who I will also point out, I grew up watching him for current events in high school. That's sort of the place that I come from. Like, Rush Limbaugh spent 40 minutes on air talking about the problems with my book, right? So that doesn't mean that I have a bad idea. That means that I have a pretty good and powerful idea. That's my decision. Right, because if we accept that fresh and healthy food is not a luxury product, like that we don't, the problem is not that we need to convince people to buy it, but that we need to make it affordable and accessible, that's a radically different proposition, right? So people, like in the U.S., traditionally, when we're talking about how do we change the way people eat, right, we talk about encouraging people to do different things with their dollar. Like, that's part of the public discourse in terms of sort of government's role, right? We've had the USDA and the Nutrition Service come up with different recommendations for how we should eat, right? And we spend all this time and energy getting really obsessed with, like, what are we supposed to eat? Are we supposed to eat corn syrup? Are we not supposed to eat corn syrup? Are we supposed to eat this vegetable or that vegetable? Like, yeah. I would like to point out that we have been pursuing that strategy for at least as long as I've been on this earth, and it doesn't appear to be working, right? We have been telling people the same basic thing, which is eat your vegetables, right, since before I was born. And Americans today, only 12% of us eat our recommended daily allowance of fruits and vegetables. And today, we only grow about half the fruits and vegetables in the U.S. that would be needed for all Americans to meet the recommended daily allowance, right? So that means two things, right? Either we are all lazy and stupid, it's possible, and I've certainly have met some people where I would argue they're probably lazy and stupid, but, you know, or it's really difficult in the terms of our political and social and work lives right now to eat well. And that if we actually care about people eating well, if that's actually what our concern is, if it's not an aesthetic concern, if it's not just sort of a lofty cultural thing, if what we actually care about is people being able to eat well, we need to make it easier for them to do that. Because we can argue as long as we want about what people should be doing, people will do stuff when it's easy. Right? Right now we have a food system that makes junk food plentiful, affordable, and easy. And we eat a ton of it. It's not just because it's, you know, salty that we eat it. We eat it because it's easy. And we need to start having a discussion about how do we make it possible for food to be easy for people. You know, and one of the things, I mean, to be entirely honest, right, one of the things that led me to do this book was just I was so tired of hearing people talk about how we just need to spend more money and spend more time and take more care with our meals as if everybody must have, like, a maid at home, right, and have unlimited time and money. And that, for me, was really upsetting, right, because the families I grew up with didn't have those options. The people I reported on didn't have those options. And, you know, something that sort of crystallized this for me, and sort of where I see my place in the discussion around food, right, is that there's been a lot of discussion about paying higher prices for food. And I want to point out, I totally believe in paying farmers fairly for their products. And we can talk later about sort of how food prices work and how you could keep food affordable and whatever. Right? But, you know, the idea that we should just pay more. And you hear this argument that, well, you know, Americans spend less on their food than people in Europe, which as a proportion of our income is true. So on average, Americans spend about 13% of their budget on their food. And the French, for example, spend about 19%. Something that to me was really shocking was that, you know, I'm trained as a poverty and welfare reporter, so I can out-statistic most people. And so I went and I dug up the statistics about how people's spending differs by economic class. And really interestingly, as you go down the economic ladder, the share of income that is spent, or the share of budget that is spent on food, rises dramatically. So families, households that are earning between $5,000 and $10,000 a year, they spend 35% of their income on food. Right? The top third income bracket in the US, and this was shocking to me that the top third started this high. The top third is, or this low? Anyway, the top third income bracket, which is families, households earning $70,000 a year or more, they spend 8% of their income on food, right? So this indicated to me a couple of things. Like one, that the people talking about how we should be spending our food budget must be from the 70% or the $70,000 a year crowd, because families spending 25% of their income on food, I'm not so comfortable telling them to spend more. You know, families with more income, more flexibility, like they can do that. And so I've really been engaging with this, right? So how do we do this? How do we build a food system where we can have affordable and good food and it's easy? And can we do that? Can we as Americans begin to engage with food as if it is this public and social good? And the more that I looked at this, the more that I really came to focus actually on grocery stores. Because we talk about grocery stores as if they are just these static places, right, that we go to, they're a portal. But actually they're a distribution network, particularly because so much of the logistics are brought in-house now. So, you know, supermarkets, you know, the store that you go to is like the faucet in your house, right, or obviously outside of your house. But supermarkets control like all the plumbing, right, from the water source, from the spring. And so if we really want to begin to engage with the idea of how do we build a decentralized and a flexible and a powerful food system that can feed us all, we've got to start dealing with this question of distribution. And interestingly, right, today we have about 14 million Americans living in food deserts. So these are communities with limited grocery stores. Distribution of food, supermarket development, all that, that is the one area of specific concrete human need, right, food, that's been left in terms of distribution entirely to the private market. And I am not against the presence and use of markets, but government and market are different tools. They are means to an end. They are not the end in and of themselves. And I really have come to believe we need to start having a conversation about how do we make sure we get food into communities, that's the conversation to have. How do we make it easy, right? How do we make it so that I walk out of my house and I can get fresh food really easily at an affordable price? And interestingly, because I've been living in New York, I've had the sort of insanely beautiful experience of seeing my reporting lead to changes in my neighborhood. So I can tell you, when I started reporting on food and food access about 10 years ago, I did the first analysis of food access in New York City. So this was something where a bunch of advocates were saying, oh, well, you know, there's no grocery store in the ghetto, and that's why people eat badly. And I was sort of like, well, I live in the ghetto. I live in Bed-Stuy. Like, I have a grocery store. It's not great. You know, I did grow up with a crummy rural grocery store, so it didn't seem so weird to me what I saw in my own grocery store. So I don't know about that. Do you have some numbers? Because I'm a reporter, so if you tell me something, I want you to prove it to me. And they said, no, we don't have that. So I went, and I figured it out, and I did this sort of number-crunching Excel sheet thing, and we ended up with a list of every zip code and the sort of degree of food access in those communities. And people actually began to use it, right, to advocate for a farmer's market in this neighborhood or that neighborhood. No, because nobody was measuring this. Government wasn't talking about it. Nobody knew. And over time, what has happened is the city government there has begun to study this and begun to push for supermarkets to build in communities or to locate in communities. And because I live in Bed-Stuy, it's sort of one of the focal communities. And when I was working on this book, I basically gave up my life for 3 years, which is not in the original plan, but it happened. So I had this thing, right, of like leaving and then just sort of poof, dropping back in 3 years later. And all of a sudden, instead of having one grocery store in my neighborhood, I have four. This is also a product to some degree of gentrification, right? But it has radically shifted how well I eat, right? Because, oh, I feel like going to the Y. Oh, I can stop at the grocery store and pick up some lettuce for dinner. Oh, if I get out at this subway station, there's a supermarket right there, or this subway station, there's a different supermarket there, and I can go there. And it has made it easy for me, right, and for my neighbors to get to good food. And there's other things you have to change before diets altogether shift radically, right? I don't think that we fix obesity just by adding grocery stores. But I think that this has been like a really powerful thing for me to realize, like, oh, right, what's in my neighborhood really, really matters. And this is the sort of thing, right, that really begins to grapple with one of the premier questions in American political discourse right now, which is, you know, should we get rid of government? Like, that's a big thing, right? That's sort of what the Tea Party is interested in doing, is we get rid of government. We just have a market. And, you know, I have seen in Detroit and in my own neighborhood that the, you know, the presence or absence of markets, right, it depends in part on government often. And we've seen what happens when we just leave it to the market, right? You have whole neighborhoods where people literally believe, or some people literally believe, that the bodega is the natural food supply, right, for low-income people. It's been interesting to me. I meet a lot of people who do like commercial real estate development and supermarket development. And a friend of mine was talking to me and he's like, well, you know, to be really honest, it's like supermarkets and sort of food access, that would be a really good example of what we would call a market failure, right? And so are we cool with that? And so I guess I'm going to leave you with a question, and I really can't tell you how excited I am for the Q&A part of this, because that's usually where the fun happens. I'm going to leave you with this question, which is that if we accept this idea that building a public and social food system, right, that we have a public and so, if we accept this idea that we have a public and social responsibility to build a food system, and really that means, you know, a lot of different systems, that means government and economics, that provides us all with healthy food, you know, what else would we then start asking for? So thank you so much, and I really can't wait for your questions.
Thank you, Tracy. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. Ms. McMillan, will you please talk to us about some of the challenges of moving toward a more decentralized food system, particularly how infrastructure needs to change?
Yeah, so one of my interests in decentralized food systems really comes from the idea that we want a food supply that can respond to crisis well, right? Because one of the things that really has terrified me about realizing that Walmart and a few other supermarkets control the distribution is this idea of too big to fail, right? Because it's one thing when a corporation providing jobs is too big to fail and it goes down, but what happens when our food supply, right, or a food system? Because what if Walmart has an accounting scandal and suddenly shuts down? Like, that's a quarter of our nation's food supply, right? So a decentralized food system right, is going to be able to respond to that sort of crisis really well, because one little store goes out of business, it doesn't mean that a quarter of the country can't eat. And this is really where infrastructure becomes key, because if you are a smaller producer, and the farmers who are here will know this, right? If you're a smaller producer, your job is to grow, not necessarily to run a logistics empire. And smaller grocers, like neighborhood grocery stores and retailers, know this too, right? Like, moving all of that food and taking care of it is a really huge deal. It's really difficult. And you cannot, as a small grocer, compete with the Walmarts of the world when it comes to logistics pricing. So one of the things that I've really been playing with is trying to study and look at models of a public-private partnership to build and foster food infrastructure that is affordable to small producers and small retailers. The USDA is actually doing a little bit of this work through a project called Food Hubs. And this is something that happens in other countries. Like, you will find at big wholesale markets in Europe and in North Africa, for example, that, you know, there will be some government dude whose job it is to, like, help farmers figure out some merchandising or some marketing or how to sort of better consolidate transportation. And so I think that beginning to have a real conversation, not just about food access in terms of the store, like the faucet in your house, but in terms of the whole network behind it, is really key to that. And I think that's also, right, how we support smaller local production, which is also, right, tends to be a bit more sustainable and a little bit more friendly.
Please comment on the relationship between available food and population growth. As affordable food becomes more available, populations tend to increase. Do we need to include population management in the dialogue on affordable good food?
Population management is not my area of expertise. My reaction instinctively to that is that you need to have a conversation about sort of fertility and population control, right? Like, if you have an infrastructure where you're getting, not population control, but like contraception, right? And letting people control their fertility. Like, I think that if you have that conversation, like, you probably are not going to see a huge boom in population at the end of it. But I don't really know very much about that. It's also, I'm not aware of that in terms of it being a problem in sort of the developed world. So that might be a concern more in developing countries. But again, that's not my expertise.
What are your thoughts on the debate over taxing junk food?
Taxing junk food. Yeah, so I come at this from both ends, right? Because as a working class kid, a lot of the discussion around that stuff tends to be really condescending. And so I really react to that, right? Like, I don't think anybody likes being told what to do or what's right or wrong for them, particularly something as personal as what you're eating. At the same time, when you are spending so much money on public health problems derived from bad food, you know, you can make an argument for that. So, right, I would love to figure out maybe like a pilot program and see what actually happens. Or, I mean, for me, I'm less interested in taxing the bad stuff than I am in subsidizing demand for the good stuff, which is really what these double up food bucks programs, like these matching programs, are like, because they're this coupon for people to buy fresh produce and they use them. Like, when you introduce those coupons to farmers markets, people, I mean, use of food stamps will double and triple at the market, right? And so people only eat so much. So if you can make it just easier and cheaper for them to eat the good food rather than penalizing the bad. And also, I think that because the conversation and the rhetoric around taxing junk food tends to be really tricky culturally, I think that you build more solidarity and more power by subsidizing good than by demonizing bad.
Do you see a connection between lack of public transportation and access to food?
Yes. Right. So I think a really important thing to keep in mind is the geography that goes into food access. Some of you may be familiar with a piece that was published in the New York Times maybe a month or so ago, talking about two studies about food access and saying, oh, food deserts are not the same problem that everybody thinks they are. And one study was showing that there was no direct correlation between lack of food access and higher obesity rates. Which I don't think necessarily means that you don't need good food in low-income neighborhoods. And the second study was talking more about actual access to stores, and the study author said, well, you know, there's not really a problem with food deserts. There is a grocery store within a few miles of every urban area. And my response to that would be, well, Roland, are you walking 4 miles to go get your groceries every day? Right? So it's really important that, you know, transportation is a huge part of access, because that's part of what makes it easy, right? If it's easy to stop off at a store and get food, you can get good food. Otherwise, if you're tired, you just go to the bodega.
Given the roles of the USDA and agribusiness in food distribution and the impact of the politics of corn and soy production, is it possible to change the American diet?
Well, it's hard, right? I'm not saying that this is easy. I have days where I'm completely cynical and I'm like, I have no idea why I'm even bothering. This is really hard. At the same time, right, like, I think you have to try, right? I think that food, because it is something that everyone has experienced, whatever their class, like, everybody has felt hungry, right, at some point. Even if it was just a very temporary thing, this is an experience as humans we all have had and can identify with, and you can begin to build a conversation about getting good food into communities. Because I can tell you that as a welfare reporter, nobody ever really wanted to talk to me about my work. If you would like to drive away companion partners at dinner parties, I suggest welfare reform. Food, however, is something that can really begin to generate a discussion and solidarity, because we also in the U.S., right, tend to have a really difficult relationship with the idea of there being economic and social class. So getting people to talk about poverty often requires getting them to think that there are multiple classes in the U.S. Everybody, pretty much, when I talk to them, I say, well, there are some neighborhoods where it's, you know, there's one supermarket and it's not very good, and they say, oh, well, that's terrible. Then people can't eat well, right? And so there's an opportunity to begin to build political momentum for that. That said, right, like DC and agribusiness, like that's a huge problem and really difficult. And, you know, when you have things like Citizens United and all this stuff happening, like, I don't know, maybe.
Some people, leaders in the local, this is someone who's clearly spent some time in Detroit or is following the Detroit situation. Some people, leaders in the local food movement in Detroit, challenge the claim that it should be considered a food desert. The challenge is not because there are so few grocery stores, but because of the large growth of gardens, over 2,000 in the city. How do you respond to this?
Right, I went to Detroit because of its myth as a food desert, and it does have a difficulty with food access. Like, there are totally neighborhoods where it's very, you know, you have to drive quite a ways to get to some good food. That said, right, there tends to be this real conflation of the fact that there are no national grocery chains there with the idea that there are none, right? So even when I will be talking to reporters who are interviewing me about the book and I say, well, it's important to remember Detroit has 85 or 100 grocery stores. It's just that there are no national chains. And they will say, okay, so since Detroit has no grocery stores, right? So it's difficult and important to remember, right? Detroit does have some grocery stores. And also the food gardens there have been an amazing source of fresh and healthy food there. And this is another thing, right, that I think really gets to this idea that people really do want good food. Because if people in Detroit are so starved for good, fresh food that you have 2,000 gardens, which are community gardens, right, so it's more than one person, like, dedicated to providing good food in the community, right, that supermarkets can't really argue that there's no demand, right? There's demand for good food. It's just that nobody's been bothering to provide it.
How important are school gardens in teaching healthy food choices?
I think school gardens are really important in teaching healthy food choices, and I would also incorporate, I really do think everybody should take like a really high quality home ec course to be able to cook basic food from scratch. I think that probably would be as powerful or more powerful than gardens, because you would begin to build a population, right, that has an appreciation for the difference between different quality ingredients. And that would be able to feed themselves. Like, I think this is really key, right? Food and cooking is part of self-sufficiency. And we tend to sort of skip over that and say, oh, it's really cultural, it's beautiful. And I don't care anymore about the froofy part of cooking. Like, you can take all the fancy cookbooks and food magazines and throw them in the garbage. I want everybody to be able to feed themselves and make decisions about their food and their lives for themselves with agency and empowerment, right? Instead of being stuck with, I don't really know what to cook, so I'll just buy a box with directions on it.
How much do you think Walmart drives down the wholesale prices to farmers?
Walmart drives down, I don't know the degree to which Walmart drives down wholesale prices, but they drive it down a lot. There's a lot of case studies about this, whether it's, you know, with a pack of shaving cream with Procter & Gamble or pickles with Vlasic, right? Because Walmart is such a huge purchaser, right, they can tell the person supplying them what they will pay them for their product. And I want to point out, this is a radical inversion of usual market economics. It's called a monopsony, right? When we learn basic economics as kids, right, it's I am going to make a product and I will sell it to someone and I will have many people to sell it to, and then we will negotiate a price that I think is fair and that they think is fair. But when you get down to only one or two people that you can possibly sell to, and one of them, if you sell to them, will give you access to this giant market, right, that person that is buying your product can tell you what they're going to pay for it. And that's the situation we're in with Walmart right now.
How do you think that the media's role in processed food and junk food affects children of the working class?
Right. So I'm going to presume that by media we mean advertising. And I would say that I think that stuff is really powerful. It's also obviously part of a family's responsibility to be working with their kids about, you know, what you eat at home. I also say that, by the way, as somebody who is not a parent, so you can tell me to shove it if I'm being ridiculous. You know, I go back and forth about, do you regulate advertising and things like that, because I think there are other things that are more important. You know, advertise all you want. If really good, healthy food is affordable and accessible, like, see if the junk food is still winning. I don't think it would be.
To make it easier to eat well, is the cooperative movement a potential player, as in Europe, or is the co-op movement just another brand?
So I'm guessing that would be food cooperatives and not housing cooperatives.
Yeah, food right. Cooperatives or CSAs.
Or CSAs. I think that those are really important institutions, particularly because they show the depth of investment and interest in good quality food. I think it's hard, a lot of that's hard to scale up, right? So when you're talking about feeding an entire nation of 300 million people, it's difficult. You know, I belong to a food co-op in Brooklyn, and it's awesome, right? And I have to go and work 3 hours a month, and I whine and complain like everybody else, and I'm totally happy to go and whine and complain and put up with the crazy people because I get amazing food. And I think that for me, what's really empowering about that is that I can be like, I'm making this trade-off. I spend 3 hours a month, and I get awesome food, right? And I think that, like, the more we can open up those sorts of choices for more people, the more powerful it becomes.
How about government-subsidized junk and fast foods in school lunches?
Right. I don't like that there are government-subsidized fast and junk food in school lunches. Basically, I think the movement to politicize and build better school lunches is incredibly powerful, not just because, like, yeah, our kids should have good food, but because it builds an institutional purchaser for good quality food. And this is really important, right? Because it builds a marketplace for smaller and mid-sized growers, right? Food, school districts are very geographically centered and located. They can't do the same kind of sort of nationwide institutional purchasing. And so when you're building like an infrastructure in a local community to support small and mid-sized growers, and then you're making sure kids get really good food, like, that's a total win-win.
Thank you again, Ms. McMillan, for sharing your time and expertise with us today. You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org or by writing the Monadnock Lyceum Committee, 25 Main Street, Peterborough, New Hampshire, 03458. The program next Sunday will feature Gus Speth, who will be speaking about forging a new politics to drive real change in America.